Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, this podcast is all that you get. Josh and Antonio might be it, but heaven knows they'll try.
A Ted Lasso podcast and post-show recaps, you better believe it. Welcome to our Ted Lasso talk, talking about the season two finale of Ted Lasso in, was it inverting or inventing the pyramid of success, Antonio? I still don't know.
I think it inverted it.
Does that mean
if you invert the pyramid of success, does that mean failure? We did not talk about that last week, but it seems to me like the pyramid of success, the John Wooden pyramid of success, we see in this episode, if you invert it, then the inversion of success is failure, yes?
I suppose that that's right. Or is it just some kind of, is the inversion of success something that is closer to being pronounced sucks?
Oh, no. Really? Is that what we're doing?
Is that
a tease for a Succession podcast?
Oh, well, we do have Succession podcasting available to you right now, dear post-show recaps listener. If you are not already aware, go seek out the Succession podcast here on post-show recaps. We've got a feed you can sign up for. Really hyped as Succession returns next week. Is that the anti-Lasso Succession?
I wouldn't say anti. I mean, both are about teams of people. perhaps that's where the comparison ends. There's big daddy issues.
There is some soccer in Succession.
That's true. Is it
limited
hearts?
Amounts?
Limited yeah, I think amounts. It's hearts.
Anyway,
big daddy issues present in Succession. Obviously,
yes.
Not big daddy with Adam Sandler. Different thing.
That's a different podcast series we are launching soon here on PSR.
Large Father here.
Large Fathers. Yes, it's going to be a great, great series of shows. No, we are talking about Ted Lasso today. That is the thing that is front and center here as we are not quite concluding our Ted Lasso coverage for season two. We will be back next week for sure with a feedback show. So we want to make sure we're hearing from you on all of that. TedLasso@postshowrecaps.com is the email address. And of course, you can talk to us in the Post Show Recaps patron Discord. If you are a patron at any level, you are able to get into the Post Show Recaps patron Discord for the month of October. So consider signing up, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Next week, we may or may not have a special guest as well. So there will be an additional perspective to weigh in on the events of not just the finale, but season two of Ted Lasso, and maybe meditate a bit on the future of the show as well. And then beyond that, we'll see what the appetite is both for Antonio and myself, but also you, dear listener, of how much more Ted Lasso you want us to talk about here on the podcast. But at the very least, Antonio, season two is officially in the books. And if the initial plan holds, Antonio, we are officially two-thirds of the way through, as outlined, Ted Lasso seasons 1-3.
It's been a wild ride. Like, I am surprised we ended up where we ended up. It just, I remember talking to you about, are we going to podcast about the show? How are we going to get there? It was early in the summer, I think. We were like, do we do one a week as
right.
a rewatch, Lasso Road? We didn't do that. We started with season two. It just seems like it's 3 full months ago. And much has changed. I mean, my opinion of the show has not changed. Maybe it is. Evolved to the point that I feel like it's so much more than it was in season one, if by only by virtue of the longer episodes. I feel like we're trending into a different territory for this show. It's definitely not just a workplace sitcom. It is now, I think, a dramedy or certainly a prestige TV, 42-minute show. So
yeah.
The finale delivered on that front as well. And I was I was very satisfied and pleased with the finale. I feel a little bit vindicated or validated with all the time we spent on the various plot lines and talking out the various stories. It's clear to me that the writers of this show do have a plan. Whether we agree with some of the beats of that, and we'll certainly talk about them from this episode, I definitely feel like there's a lot of signposting that we did here on the podcast and that the show did throughout the season to get us to where we ended up by the end of this finale. And I was very satisfied. And we buried the lead here, not the lead that's in the tabloids about Ted, but Richmond's going back up, Josh, back to the Premier League they go.
They are. And I think that like it would have been a much bigger surprise if they didn't, right? Like, I think like there is the degree to which like some of the finale has, it has a few beats that are like, expected to the point of like inevitable that like if this is going to be like a 3-season arc, as Jason Sudeikis has apparently outlined, and his collaborators have seemingly backed to a point, we'll see where that goes. Money talks. So who knows? I don't think we're getting money on the podcast anytime soon. But you never know.
By Pink Floyd?
You never know. We could get a Pink Floyd at some point. But there are, like, it would have been really surprising if, they hadn't moved up, right? Like, if we had gone into season 3 and we were still, like, where we were with the club. But I think, like, the trade-off there is, like, Richmond's success has to come at the expense of, certain, whether it's, outright regressions for certain characters or, like, full-on, like, falls from grace. Or even just, you know, like little setbacks, or in some cases, like steps forward that may be very helpful for them as people and for the people around them, but also maybe a little bit sad to weather at the same time. A lot of change, I think, is the point. That there is success in terms of the club, but a lot of change and disappointment for specific individuals around the Richmond family. And we'll talk about all of that. And I think like that is the way in which this is inverting success, right, Antonio? Like it's success on the field, but in certain regards at what cost?
And I think that's right. I think a huge part of what they did to get there, I found the that's what makes the sauce so awesome is what Chris Pratt says is a character moment for Andy Dwyer on Parks and Recreation. Like part of why Richmond succeeded, their pyramid of success had to do with the combination of all the people that were involved and what they contributed. Nate obviously ends this episode in a very different place, physically, specifically in terms of employment, like all of the things and ways that this season changed. We begin and end the season with Nate's face, but what a journey that face went on. But the success of AFC Richmond being promoted was down to so much, not just the lasso ethos, not just believe, not just touching the sign and being good to each other and being kind to each other and understanding Jamie giving Danny the ball and those things. But it's also Nate's tactics. It is the false nine that they stuck with tactically that had a huge impact. So what made AFC Richmond a successful team, the pyramid that built that up, has been inverted. It's been changed. And I guess the question as we go into season 3 with Richmond returning to the Premier League, with Rupert now owning West Ham United and Nate coaching there, is what does that inverted pyramid look like now that we've flipped that over and we don't have a very strong base leading to a point at the top, and instead we maybe invert that. Is series 3 going to be rough? Like, without Nate, is there actually going to be a significant negative impact without his tactics on the club? And I think it'll be interesting to see as we move forward. If the pyramid of what made Richmond successful in this season was inverted, what does that lead to in Series 3? Like you, Josh, as you said, Jason Sudeikis, 3-season arc. It has always been, it feels like Ted's meta mission statement at the end of Season 1 to Rebecca is we're going to go to the championship, we're going to get relegated, then we're going to get promoted, and then we're going to go win the whole effing thing. I'm one of the few times Ted Lasso swears to underscore a point. So it feels like we are headed in that direction, but it's the how we get there that's very interesting to me. And that was certainly the case here. I think you made a great point last week about how you can't just have them stay in the second division or in the championship and doing a lot of the same stuff over and over again that we did this season. It's a much more natural arc for them to be back in the Premier League and to really be competing for that Premier League championship. So I'm looking forward to seeing that, but it will be interesting to see how the success comes, if it comes.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to talk about the episode specifically, how things landed, where things could be going based on where it landed. We will go through the characters. We'll go through all of the big beats. We are going to take a quick break to throw it to our sponsors for this episode of Post Show Recaps. And when we come back, we're going to dig into all of it. Stay tuned.
Enjoy the banter.
All right, we're back. Banter has been enjoyed. Oh my gosh, there's got to be careful with the context of that. Banter has been enjoyed. Yeah, it's probably not true. Something I should say.
Oh dear, it was on this season. It's certainly.
Oh my geez.
I figured they were sponsoring us now. I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't think that they are. Anyway, Antonio. I mean, there's so many different places where we could start, right? Like, basically, like, just like some snapshots is like, Nate has gone off. Nate has gone full gray. We should have known it by the hair all season long. We should have been tracking that. As a huge fan of the video game Shadows of the Colossus, I take this as a personal failing on my end. That video game does something similar. And didn't clock the hair, but Nate has gone full Vader. He's like full, I don't want to say Cobra Kai because I haven't watched the show, though perhaps I should. He feels like, you know, he's running like the evil dojo by the end of the season. So we have that on the board. We have that confrontation between him and Ted. He's ripped up the believe sign. We have seen how Ted has responded to what happened to him, to what Nate did. We've seen that Ted has responded with just a really admirable levels of maturity and openness and trying to bring things back together with Nate unsuccessfully. So much to discuss there. A really sad in many ways, like I feel like a fuller Ted Lasso, but also a really sad Ted Lasso, the character in this episode that I want to get into all of that. There's Roy and Keeley. We have a big cliffhanger there. Will they, won't they? Roy wants Keeley to go on vacation with him. She is not going to be able to go because she's starting her own business. Is this just the show trying to ease us into realizing these two are not going to be together anymore or for much longer? That's a thing to talk about. Sam is sticking around. He's opening his own restaurant, but he's doing it for him and not for Rebecca. Sam been wildly verbally abused by Edmund Okufo.
Incredible.
One of the great scenes of the finale, for sure. So
of the series.
Have we seen the last of Okufo, or is that a warning shot? I don't know either. I really hope not, too. So that's on the board as well. And then Trent Krim, the independent for reals this time, responding to all of the cries for that's bad journalism with, I agree, which is why I've left. And Trent
good,
Krim.
That was pretty good, Trent Krim.
Not bad, right? He's out in the wind, Trent Krim. So these
that
are just
hair's
like
going to look great in the wind.
Yeah, he could do whatever he wants now. That's fantastic. So those are just like a few of like the major, major broad strokes headlines. If you were looking to just get outright spoiled on it without like any deeper analysis, those are the things. But how did those things swirl together for you, Antonio, as far as an episode of television on its own merits, but also one that has like the narrative energy and responsibility of the previous 11 episodes of the season, not to mention the 10 episodes of the first season on its back?
That is a lot to carry. That is a lot to carry. And I read an interview with Bill Lawrence, the co-creator, co-creator of Ted Lasso from Deadline, where he points out as well, like where we are essentially somewhere in series two here is the midpoint of the show. Like they have three season arcs for most of the characters, major and minor. I also listened to Bill Lawrence on the TV's Top 5 podcast from your old stomping grounds, Josh, the Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah, Dan and Leslie. I haven't gotten a chance to listen yet, but I'm really excited to.
Yeah, really good. Dan and Leslie, always great. Always great. And they asked some good questions, some interesting questions. I thought the overall takeaway, though, is that, yeah, there is a lot that was weighing down on this season. But they have, I think, a pretty clear plan. Bill Lawrence said something to the effect of major or minor characters. They really sat down and plotted out arcs for everybody, even prior to breaking series two or season two. So they're in a position where I think we are just sort of along for the ride. They clearly are responding to some of what they're seeing when they see characters that have good chemistry, or when they know the actors really like each other, or there's a really good performance, or something particular is happening. They're definitely responding to that in the moment. But a lot of this stuff is mapped out. So this season had a lot to carry, as you were saying, but it does feel to me at this point, now having seen the whole second season, that they did have a plan. There are definitely things that I feel a little questionable about I definitely want to talk about with you. Certain storylines that I'm not sure the reason for them, or if we feel satisfied about the fact that we got them. I think the Roy and Keeley story is there. Certainly, Sam and Rebecca is there. So some of these relationship-based things, I think we can get into. But I think the overall takeaway that I have in terms of like this season having to carry that weight is because it's already planned out and plotted out, I just think that it maybe is almost unfair to look at this season and say anything other than whether we feel this season accomplished things on its own, because it does still feel so much part of a living product that is not, you know, complete with the life cycle yet. So they have a plan for how this thing's going to age up. And I don't think it's fair for us necessarily to say, well, it's not aging up well, because I just don't know that we know how some of this stuff is going to go. Clearly, the Nate stuff was arced out. I think that's a very good example. And I think it's actually an interesting place to start because, of course, Nick Mohammed, the actor who fantastically, by the way, in this episode and throughout, plays Nate.
It was so brutal to watch. He did such an effective job. I cannot come out harder for Nick Mohammed as an actor, and such an unenviable job to be the bad guy on Ted Lasso, like a thing you really don't even want. And right. He has to embody that. That's really, really hard, especially when, you know, his background with the series is being like a really lovable character in the first season, who for sure has moments where he's like the facade is cracking, as he has eloquently outlined, which I'm sure you're going to point to. Just such a hard job. And I think he did such a great job. Like, before we start to like tear the character apart, like I want to lead with that Nick Mohammed is just amazing.
You're correct. And always right to point out the differences between character and actor. And I will say the tweet where Nick Mohammed weighed in on his views about Nate's arc this season, scrolling through the replies, so much support of people saying you did such a good job, such an unenviable task, all the things you were saying. Like I do feel like that is the predominant, the vastly predominant view of the public who were watching this play out. That said, people hate Nate, man. Like, people really do hate this character now. So such an effective job. You're my friend and yours, and your Down the Hatch co-host here at Post Show Recaps, Mike Bloom, has recently started watching Ted Lasso.
Don't spoil Mike, folks. He's working his way through.
Don't spoil Mike. And Mike is in our Discord channel just commenting, not necessarily reading. And he said, like, I'm only three episodes into season one, but I gather I'm gonna hate Nate. It's like, you cannot escape this. Like, people are talking about it. And there are a lot of really key points, and we've pointed to a lot of them throughout the course of this podcast. But I would encourage everybody to read Nick Mohammed's Twitter feed if you have not. It's at Nick Mohammed. This is his pinned tweet. And he just basically says, here are a few of my thoughts on Nate in responses to your tweets. And then he writes basically a bullet point list of all the reasons why he feels like this Nate stuff and the DNA of the evolution of Nate is very present within the context of Ted Lasso. A lot of them, you know, as I said, we have discussed at length on this podcast, like the roast from season one, where he's just very quick. To get right in there. Like, he very much enjoys that. And he's bullied throughout season one. So that makes some sense in that context. But we didn't, I think, really stop to contextualize in that moment, like, the larger character of Nate. Who is this guy? Why is he so quick to push back? What level did the bullying really affect him? Nick Mohammed put in his tweet, "It's payback time," with an exclamation mark, talking about that. But, like, clearly, this is a guy who has been abused, bullied, picked on, not treated well. And Ted came along and made him feel like $1 million and then didn't anymore, according to the monologue there in at the big confrontation scene, right, between Nate and Ted. And so a lot of this is there. There's just a lot of other really good examples in this tweet of some of the microaggressions and some of the things that Nate experienced or was on the receiving end of. If you've listened to this podcast throughout, this is mostly stuff that we have covered, but seeing it all spelled out like this, I think it makes it really clear that there is a lot more nuance to this. We joked a couple of weeks ago that this is like they put the prequels and Empire Strikes Back into the same season of television, and you're seeding this Anakin situation here with Nate. But he really has joined the dark side. But I think there's some, this is more than just like my mom died kind of dark side stuff. Like this is real dark side stuff. Or I guess my mother of my children in the prequel sense. Spoilers alert for the Star Wars prequels.
You're good. You're good. Deidre, those were Star Wars references.
Yes. Oh, point shouting it out directly for Deidre. That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I don't know. How do you feel now that we're at the end of the season? How do you feel about the Nate arc and sure. whether it was seated properly?
So my first thought is, oh no, you're really gonna give him that hair for season three?
That's like, a wig.
We're gonna put Nick Muhammad in a wig for wig season watch. Three. Like, we're really gonna do that. I think actually though, this may be a hot take, or this could be a premonition that we will look back on and see like, okay, that bared out. I think that like evil sort of Cobra Kai sensei Nick Muhammad as Nate with like a wig that signifies his turn towards villainy is going to be like so hammy that I think it could like arc us back towards beginning the process of like getting, if not good with Nate, then like building something different with Nate to enjoy him more as a character. I think that there could be something like almost a little bit like slapsticky about the visual. Yeah. Because if this is like the Darth Vader arc, yeah, we're just spoiling Star Wars. Sorry if that's you who you've managed to make it all this time and it happened for you on a Ted Lasso podcast, but it's happening for you on a Ted Lasso podcast unless you skip away. Like, if we're doing the Darth Vader-ish arc with Nate, then like he has to like do something akin or Anakin even.
To throwing
Palpatine down like you know, all of, like the power shaft or whatever the hell that thing is. You know, he's gonna have to throw him down, and so like what's he gonna do to Rupert for Ted, right? Like something like that will go down. So I think like you have to see like some semblance of like the building back up arc in season three, and your mileage is really gonna vary with Nate, and it seems like most people's mileage is just like the outright F Nate. And I can't like, I'm not going to like defend against that. I'm not going to like clap back against that. All I can tell you is how I felt. Like logic aside, anything aside other than how I felt, and how I felt watching him, especially like in like the beginning of the episode, like him like having to like live in like the coexistence of like how Ted is responding to this story. And how people were responding to Ted's response to the story, and like the "Have I been caught?" like all of this stuff, like you know, like there was like a sense of like fear and shame, and then when he's not caught, that's like turning into like anger because he's not being admonished. He doesn't get admonished by Roy for kissing Keeley, all of this stuff, and like everything that he's doing is awful. Like what he's doing is awful, and
he
there's
ripped
no
the sign.
There's no excuse for it. There's like no excuse. There's no justification. There are maybe like inroads to like understanding how a human being does the things that he does. And I think that some of those inroads are like when you've seen this person, like when you've been with this person, when you've spent time with this character, and when you've like, when this is somebody who you have, you know, loved as a fictional character, that this shit's just sad. It's really, really, really sad. And our world is populated by so many Nates. Like we live in a world where people behave this way.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's due to perceived slights or actual slights that fester and metastasize into this really horrible, like spewing of malignance. You know, like it's just very, very sad. And watching Nate's arc more than anything, more than feeling angry, I felt like a lot of like pity and sorrow and sadness for so much of like a swath of our human population, of like the modern person. And it was really, really, really effective performing from Nick Muhammad in that character, in that character moment, with just like the whole like F you Ted and the way that he like threw it all at him. Like, I think a lot of people's rightful response to that is just like, F this guy. This guy is just being horrible. And there's no question in my mind that he's being horrible and like F the things that he's doing. But that's also, that's Nate. You know, it's Nate. And it's this person who, as Nick Muhammad points out in his tweet, that when you go to Ted Lasso's flat, you see that there's like the picture on his mantle that Nate gave him for Christmas is right next to like Ted's picture of his kid. Like, he loves Nate. He cares about Nate. And he just didn't give Nate all the things that Nate needed, and didn't know that that was something that he had to do. But, like, I don't think that, like, even seeing that Believe poster at the end of the season being ripped in half and knowing who did that, like, even after he said F you to Ted, that, like, when they're back on the pitch and, like, things are starting to turn up and, like, Ted's, like, excited about that, like, he even, like, goes over to Nate and, like, hits him on the shoulders. You know, like he even like has that moment.
Yeah.
So like I feel like there's a piece of me that like I'm trying to like follow Ted's lead on this, which is I think that Ted isn't angry. I think Ted's heartbroken. I think that this broke Ted's heart. And I think it's going to like I think you see that in like the rest of the episode. A thing that I kept waiting for was Ted's resignation by the end of the episode. And when he was like going in to Rebecca's office, like I kind of expected that might be a resignation scene. And it wasn't. It was like actually like a fairly insubstantial scene between Ted and Rebecca.
Yeah.
You know, like basically devoid of substance entirely other than Rebecca and Sam. So I really thought that that might be where we were at because he was so sad. He was so upset about like what has happened to this person. How could he have failed this person? And like those are, I think, things that he is feeling. And in many ways, like probably really unnecessarily, like taking a lot of the hits on this. But other ways in which he's probably trying to examine, like, where did this go wrong? And I think that like we are still trying to unpack that, even with the things that Nick Muhammad has pointed out as an actor, which you can read about in postmortems, or even when Nate gives his tirade in The Office. I think it is perfectly acceptable, beyond acceptable, to have like a very violently angry reaction to this character and what he's doing and how he's behaving. I can only just speak for myself, Antonio. I just feel like really sad and upset about it.
I understand. I do. And for me, it's so wrapped up in the communication breakdown that happened between Ted and Nate that happened in part because Ted was so in his own head this season. And that part makes me feel some type of way. I don't exactly know how to phrase it, but I'm in a situation where I don't want the show's suggestion to be, if you do the work and you focus on yourself, then people around you are going to be let down by you, are going to be disappointed. And they're going to be problems of your own creation because you didn't spend time focusing on other people. You spent time focusing on yourself, which is exactly what happened with Ted this season, right? Ted has been absentee in a way. He didn't know what was going on. He did not intend the microaggressions to be microaggressions, but they were. He wasn't paying attention. He didn't get it. And part of the reason why is his head was in a million other places for a million other reasons. Like you said, for leaving his family behind, for doing what he is doing, and for expressing the things that he expressed in terms of the choices he made when he gives his great speech to the team in this episode, that the team is immediately behind him because it's just like, we understand, coach. We understand, and we've got your back. So I don't want the takeaway.
And also, we'll kill the mole. Whoever's the mole will kill the mole.
I love that so much. I love Bumbercatch screams, follow the money! Yeah. I laugh so hard. Because follow the money has very little to do with this, and yet it is perfectly conspiratorial in its tone and in its delivery. Like, everything about that was so funny. But that speech, I think, does speak to Ted's vulnerability. I don't want Ted to have setbacks. I got to say, the most pleasing thing to me about this episode, rather other than any of the actual outcomes of the season or any of that stuff, is that after that such a mental health hit, having his problems exposed nationally, internationally, the way that they were and why they were exposed because of Nate and how that feels like a personal failure to Ted and all of that, I'm so glad that Ted's mental health was in a good place this episode. I'm so glad for that.
Yeah.
Because I, like I said, my biggest concern about this is I don't want anybody to have the takeaway that if you do the work and you're focusing on yourself, that you're doing something wrong or that bad things will happen. I don't like the inference, just like I didn't like the inference that Nate leaked to the paper because he had a bad romantic interaction with Keely and felt stupid as a result.
I still think they did a bad job connecting those things.
Inelegant, for sure. Sure. At a minimum. But so I don't want the inference of this to be Ted's doing the work, and because Ted was doing the work, Ted was asleep at the wheel in terms of paying emotional and compassionate attention to others. I think there's a lot of reasons why Ted was somebody who maybe made Nate feel like a superstar in Series 1 and then did not in this one. There were a lot of reasons to explain that. Part of it is, I think Ted has this relationship with Beard and a little bit with Roy where Ted doesn't really get into a lot of this really deeply personal stuff. He and Beard exist on a level where they don't have to commune that way to support each other. But the times when they really do need to do it are significant because they are more limited and because they are more serious and more real. I love their relationship, but it is not one where Ted's constantly around making Beard feel like $1 million, or Ted is paying a ton of attention to Beard's mental health. He lets Beard kind of be out there in the world and be Beard. And maybe that's not the best thing, but that's their relationship. And I feel like Ted was just very trusting of Nate. Nate's interpretations of all this stuff, obviously way out of left field, but understandable, still in the ballpark, right? Like, he's not saying like, Ted, when I didn't see the picture in the office, I assumed you hated me. He was hurt. He was hurt by that. Never assuming that Ted ripped up the picture or threw it away. He never really assumed what might have happened with it. He just noted that it wasn't there.
Right.
His problem is he never really thought, maybe he took that home and it was very personal to him. So those little misunderstandings, they definitely come as a result of communication breakdown between a manager and one of his employees. And as I said at the outset of this podcast, I feel validated, vindicated, whatever you want to, V word you want to use, for the emotional and otherwise time investment in this season. Because at the beginning of this season, we were saying like, so Ted's just going to bring Jamie back to the team and not talk to Sam about it. And there's going to be no consequences. Like, in that moment, there weren't. But there were consequences for Ted's lack of attention on some of these things. And Nate is the biggest one. Nate is the chickens in their gray hair fully coming home to roost. By the way, I think you make a great point about the wig and how that allows you to maybe lean into, because we know Nick Muhammad can be very funny, devastatingly funny. Maybe it will allow them to lean into the pantomime villain aspects of Nate as this manager. And I think that tracks with Nick Muhammad pointing out that it made him think of the Premier League's pantomime villain, actually probably European football's pantomime villain, Jose Mourinho, who is a very successful coach, who is a slight of build, smallish man who has that same gray hair. And it's funny that Nick Muhammad is using Jose Mourinho as a signpost on the hair. If he uses him as a behavioral signpost, it will be very entertaining, to say the least.
Yeah. I think that there's going to be a lot of room to play with, like, because like what the setup there is, you know, we've got like the two head coach rivals, you know, and like what also is like Coach Nate's staff going to look like is a thing that I'm excited to find. Like, who are those characters going to be? Like, I think that like there's no way to like sustain that storyline without like feeding it some humanity. He can't just be like, you know, like an all the way one note evil villain. But like if they try to like go there at all, like in like a major way, I think it's going to come across as like relatively hammy in a way that I think could work, actually. So I don't know. But again, like, I think people's like ability to like tolerate that stuff is going to really vary from person to person, considering like the actually unforgivable things that he does in this episode and what he's done in this season.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's definitely room, and I'm confident Nick Muhammad can handle it. And I think you're probably right that there's the ability for them to go and be funny with this or be funnier. The other thing, too, is with Rupert being there, it isn't just the two head coaches, right? Because we've always talked about how Rebecca and Ted have these weird connective moments. The show has remarked on it and how their stories are similar. Rebecca's sort of mirror image or dark shadow or whatever you want to call the Ted and Nate relationship there, with Rupert being there now as well, there's the opportunity to bring different level of villainy, and he can be the sort of menace or very negative energy villain in the way that Nate could be the pantomime villain. So I do think that there's room for different levels there with Rupert being in the mix as well. So there's a lot to play with, I think, and I'm definitely looking forward to it. Of course, I'm looking forward to it, but I am surprised. I am surprised that I do wonder if we're going to get any kind of backstory. What happened here? It was just a passing reference at that funeral where Rupert whispers something into Nate's ear, and the performance almost seemed to suggest that might have been their first ever conversation. Rupert was previously the owner of the club when Nate worked there, but Nate was just the kit man. So whether or not Rupert knows much about him, I don't know. What level is this? Just a spite team? Is this a Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm spite store level? Is this just a spite club? I mean, West Ham probably would fit that.
Spite club.
West Ham would fit that.
I know nothing about West Ham. Is there anything that we need to know? Like actual team? Yes.
Yeah, actual team. It fits, I think, with where you want to put AFC Richmond in terms of the sort of fictional level, because this would be like an East-West rivalry. I believe that Richmond is West London. I think West Ham, despite being called West Ham, is an East London club. And I think their traditional rivals are Millwall, who are not in the Premier League and who have probably the most notoriously terrible fan base in at least English football. So that rivalry is famously captured in the is it Elijah Wood? Is it an Elijah Wood project? The Green Street Hooligans? A football film. I can't remember who the lead of that is. I think it's Elijah Wood. Charlie Hunnam is in that movie as well. That'll tell you a little bit about West Ham, because that's about West Ham football supporters.
Forlani is in that.
Claire
as well.
Forlani is in this. Yeah that's a. It's like a hooligan. It's about hooliganism and the hooliganism in the English game. So they have a club with a big rep. One thing I will say, accidentally here on this podcast, we sort of manifested this, because earlier in the season, as Beard is being beaten down in Beard After Hours by James Tart Sr. And his boys, Marcus Mumford, the music supervisor on this show, lead singer of Mumford & Sons, does what he did in the first series when he sang You'll Never Walk Alone. He sings another football club's anthem, the Man City anthem, Blue Moon. And I joked on this podcast, what's next for series 3? Is he going to sing I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, the West Ham song? Now it seems like he actually might be doing that.
Yeah, very likely.
So it will be very interesting to see that and see how all that plays out. I don't know. I mean, West Ham, not traditionally the one of what we would call the top six clubs in English football in terms of size and revenue, but they've had some success for sure. This is not a out of nothing or nowhere club. So it will be very interesting to see if they are now being positioned as the main rival, even though Man City was in series 1 and 2, if it's now West Ham all in.
Yeah, I think it probably will be, because I think that the story is going to orient Ted against Nate, or Nate against Ted. It's, you know, poor phrasing, but like those two are in some form of opposition now, like literally professionally. That is going to be a rightful focus of the show. And I think like a lot of like character building and world building that can come stemming from that. So I'm curious to see if this is not a thing that's going to be as simple as, right, like getting Jamie Tart on board in episode two. You know, like, we can't bring Nate back into the fold three episodes into Ted Lasso season three. The depth of the impact crater, right? Like, that's just not something that can be done. Can things be, nothing's going to be reversible, at least not plausibly, I think, you know, but like, can things be like, reoriented, and can things be, can new bridges be built? Like, I think is a question that will be on the mind of the show. And I think that the show will certainly attempt that, would be my guess. Like, I think like this was a season that had darker moments for sure. And I don't think that we are out of, the woods on that stuff yet, but I also think that at the end of the day, this is a show that is meant to uplift and show the possibility of the human condition, and the things that can happen when you let go of anger and all of that stuff, and when you come together. And like, I think that the show is going to try and go there with this story. Whether that's going to be successful or not, I think is really going to depend a lot on the execution of the writing, which I do think this season has had moments where it's been really inelegant. So I don't think it's a slam dunk, to mix my sports metaphors, as far as like a thing that will for sure happen. But I think also where we are with the character and what is our own capacity to like let the show, and specifically the character of Ted Lasso, and then by extension the character of Nate, where is that gonna guide us as far as where we land with those people? I only can say that like that scene was it was such a painful scene, and I had not even really clocked that the last time that those two characters had had a scene together alone, as Nick Muhammad points out, since Ted yelled at him on the road trip in season one, and then when he apologized to him, that was the last time those two characters were alone together in a scene. Yep. Until the season two finale. Like that was the degree to which even I, as somebody who's like carefully watching the show, is like, where is this argument of neglect coming from? And then it's like, oh well, yeah, I mean, they haven't had a single conversation together in over a year. You know, is that's significant. It's not insignificant.
That is an example of elegant writing, right? Yeah. Like, that's an example of not even writing, right? Like, that's just an example of understanding how to tell a story by not telling one, like by showing that they're not together or they're not on the same page. That's just really smart. And like you said, a thing that maybe isn't immediately evident, but is definitely there. And one which I think is very telling. It's very telling for us. It's very telling for Ted and their relationship. I have a question for you. I think you said something that really resonated with me earlier, which I felt as well. But then I said to myself, Ted doesn't quit. When you said that it seemed like it would be leading to a Ted resignation, because I think Nate really scored some massive body blows there when he said,
yes,
you go back to America with your son, right? Yeah. Like, so brutal. Yeah. And I thought, okay, Ted's going to say, he's right. What the hell am I doing here? He didn't do that. But I think since Ted's not a quitter, maybe he will be by the end. Maybe he will be comfortable with quitting by the end of season three, and maybe that will be his arc in terms of getting past the issues that caused his, what we might call, toxic positivity, the issues with his father, not wanting to give up on things. Maybe now Ted will get to a place where he's comfortable choosing health and giving up on something, choosing what is there for his family. Just such an interesting thing to think about in the context of Jason Sudeikis making Ted Lasso and the debate over whether the show should continue beyond the third season, which is already planned out, the three seasons. And then there's no plan beyond that. And Jason's commitment to being away from his own family for 6 months a year. It's just, you cannot take it in on any level other than it's wild to think about the connections between the character and creator. But my thinking is there's a world where Rebecca has to fire him as well. Not one where Ted will quit. I think there's, like I said, there's elegance and beauty in his arc that he's comfortable with quitting. They win the title and he's able to walk away at the end of this series. Maybe there's one where Rebecca gets rid of him. Is there a world where the next coach of AFC Richmond is Nate Shelley?
Hard for me to envision that at this point. Really, really hard for me to see that. There's a world, but they're really going to have to work hard to earn that if it's in season three. You know, like, I think that if that is, like, in the plan after, like, the degree to which we dropped, and I'm even saying this as somebody who's, like, really working, like, at, like, feeling that empathy for the character, right? Like, right. I think that, like, it's a fatal misunderstanding of, like, the units of television. You know, like...
How many there are left?
You know, like, I think, like, we're talking, like, 12 episodes for season three if they do the same thing in season two. You cannot take this Nate and install him as the head of Richmond by the end of season three, I feel like, with that much space without, and I mean, it's something that the show introduces in this episode, time jumps. You know, time jumps can get you pretty far if they're done effectively. Yep. So, like, there's a world where that could go down. But, like, on, like, a relatively straight line of even, like, 2 months later, like, at the end of next season, like, I don't know. I don't know that we really want to see that necessarily, but... maybe. I don't know. I want to believe. I know that the believe banner has been ripped in half, but I want to believe. I want to believe in the healing possibilities in this particular storyline. But it's a really big ask. And I have a lot of respect for the show kind of like setting up that degree of difficulty for itself, because I don't think that the show is going to shy away from trying to like... get the characters and the audience at a place of peace by the end of this thing. And I think that that's going to require some measure of, like, if not outright forgiveness for Nate, then I think, like, some acceptance of the situation and what has happened here. And I think that, like, doing that well is going to be incredibly hard. And it is like a narrative, it's like a feat of narrative difficulty that you expect an Emmy winning show to attempt. Whether or not it can nail the attempt is a totally different question, but I admire the interest in going there.
Yeah, I just think it makes, I completely concur with everything you just said. I the only reason I brought it up is because in a world where I do believe that by the end of the third season, Ted will not be at AFC Richmond anymore. And it will either be by his own choice, because he takes a job with the U.S. national team, or
he did offer to resign last season.
He did offer to resign last season. That's a good point. And maybe he'll do that again, like that. And he did that in their big, like, you know, end of season kind of moment, like we had here when he comes in, and after the promotion, he came in after relegation that time. So, you know, there probably will be a third scene, with, Ted and Rebecca after the end of the season, or something to that effect. Maybe he goes back home, and maybe that's it. I don't see Coach Beard sticking around AFC Richmond without Ted. Roy could be the next head coach of AFC Richmond, but, and we'll get into this, it certainly feels like Roy's story is more about, like, Roy not necessarily needing something else. Like, it feels like this season, to an extent, Roy replaced playing football with being in a relationship with Keely. And was there constantly involved with her. Roy's a guy who, as a footballer, as an athlete, all these stories you hear about ex-athletes when they retire, they're so used to structure. They're so used to practices at this time. The matches are on these days. This is what we do. Even when you're on vacation, you're working, as Roy points out in this episode. So I don't know that a great end for that character is to become the head coach. I almost feel like the great end for that character is to realize he doesn't need any of this to be happy, that he's able to find some kind of structure or happiness absent
self-satisfaction is, yes, is an underrated skill,
right?
And like an underrated, like, place to be. Some people tell me about this state of existence.
Yes. What is this mythic world, know, that you speak of?
I've right. heard of it. I've yes. never, I've not, I believe it to be myth until I see it myself. But I think, like, something in that realm of, like, comfort within your own skin, I think, is a big piece of the Roy Kent arc, as I think, like, really underlined in his final scene in this episode.
But he's really good about some of that stuff. The Yoga Moms is a good example of that, right? Like, he doesn't necessarily even crave the spotlight. He loves that those ladies don't know who he is. Like, he loves that he's able just to hang out and watch bad reality TV. So, he is strikingly well adjusted in some ways. But I do think that the story that was told here throughout the course of this season is how he wasn't perfectly adjusted. Like, he definitely needs some educating. He needs some self-work. He needs to get into a good place. And we've seen throughout the season how good Keeley and Roy were together for each other in those ways, and how supportive they were and all of that. So there's been growth, but he's still on a path. So I don't know that that path ends with him wanting or needing the management job. It's certainly not going to be Higgins, because he's not an on-field manager. That kind of really just leaves me with, like, if Ted leaves AFC Richmond, it feels like the right one to take the job would be a Nate. Nate, who has improved. Nate, who cares deeply about AFC Richmond, even though he's now at West Ham in this anger phase. Nate the Gray. It just feels like the salute, the way to bring this back, and the nice bow is at the end of this is, you know, Trent Krim makes a joke in the first season, in the third episode, in the episode where Trent is writing the article about Nate, like, you're entrusting a Premier League team's offensive attack plan to a kit man. And Ted's like, Nate's forgotten more about this game than I ever knew. So I do think that the kit man who was featured and played such a prominent role in the early tactics of AFC Richmond, becoming the manager, somebody who cares so much, he sprinted across the pitch to yell at them to stay off of it. Like, Richmond is so important to Nate that he's away from it now out of rage and anger and in spite. If those things die down, I could see him coming back, and him coming back to be the manager seems to be the most clear thing. But you're so right that the bridge is nuked. The bridge is nuked. And so they've put themselves in a position where if they want to write their way out, it will be very interesting to see how that plays out in the third series. So I don't know. I just feel like that might be the right end for that character, but it just feels like a really long way to go to get there. I mentioned Roy Kent. What did you think, Josh, ultimately about Roy's arc over the course of this season, and generally about Roy and Keeley? How are we feeling after two series now, where we're at, with the caveat, of course, that the third series is still in play and could very well answer many of our concerns and will not play the same to those later who are watching this in a binge.
You know, there were ways in which, like, this made me sad, this ending for Roy and Keeley, and then other ways in which, like, they can come back in either of the two directions, right? Of, like, you know, from that moment that they share together, which is, what, 5 days after, you know, the match, at least 2 more months pass from that. So that's where we are, presumably, like, at least 2 months after season two is where we'll pick up in season three, would be my understanding of that. And it could be even longer. Who knows? And so I think, like, they set it up that, like, enough time passed that if Roy and Keeley are not together in season three, that I think that they could be, like, not together in a way that's, like, mature and not played for, like stupid drama. I don't want that. Like, I really don't want, like, the stupid, awkward breakup drama. Like, I feel like it's going to get frustrating and annoying. But, like, if they, like, kind of, like, got to this place where sort of, like, they drifted apart, where they don't, they're not, you know, able to be there for each other in the way that they once were, that, like, there could be, like, there could be a world where that works. I'll be bummed, and, like, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel here. Like, is this, like, a will they won't they? Are they going to get back together? Did they break up? What just happened? I feel like a scene like this, Antonio, it's hard for me to imagine why it exists unless they're not together at the start of season three. Like, I feel like this was a breakup scene, to some extent at least. And yeah. I'm sad about it for sure. But I really liked so much of what they did with Roy this season. And not just, like, his, like, the love for the game that he found, like, or rediscovered, you know, like, in some ways, like, the climax of his arc is him, you know, rushing to join the coaching staff. And that whole sequence is still just so lovely. But in other ways, like, it was, like, the journey of him, like, to become, like, a really strong coach. Part of that was, like, learning how to, like, let go of your personal stuff with like people you don't particularly like that much. And so like in that regard, what I really love the most about like the Roy and Keeley-ish stuff of the season finale is how Jamie fits into it. And Jamie showing up being like, I have to talk to you. And Roy, like, do you want to go first? Because if you don't, I may just kill you and you won't have a chance to talk. And then Jamie just like says it all. It's like, that was like an extremely shitty thing of me to do. I'm really sorry. I shouldn't treat people that way. And Roy even like having to be like, damn it. Like, I forgave him, you know, and even like Roy, like kind of like being in on the Diamond Dogs thing by the end of the season. I don't know. All of that stuff really, really, really worked for me. How about for you?
I did love the Roy and Jamie moments for sure. Like the apology was so great. Phil Dunster has been so good as Jamie Tart. It's a very funny performance. He really does thread the needle of like so stupid and yet almost profound, both profoundly stupid and just profound. Like he really does sometimes know exactly what to say, even though it's shocking that he would understand it. And every now and then he busts out of Philistines where, yes, we know the word, but it's not clear what he meant to say instead of Philistines because he clearly wasn't using it correctly.
Right.
And there are those moments that are very funny. But then there are also moments where he, like you said, he says the thing. He says everything. He's emotionally sensitive about it. I respect you. He says, I respect Kele. Like, he just really leans into it. And funerals did something to me, the dead body or whatever. It's just so very funny, but also like perfect. So I love that. And the headbutt moment at the end, like I felt really good about that. The Roy and Keeley stuff, I feel less good about. But I will reserve judgment ultimately because it is a 3-series show. I will say I'm not sure I fully feel like they accomplished what they were setting out to do. But I think they were trying. Like, I do think they were trying in terms of showing why these two people who are so great for each other might have some issues. And it's mainly just that they're at different points in their lives. And Roy has helped Keeley immensely and will continue to do so. And Keeley has helped Roy immensely and will continue to do so. But in order to be successful, we haven't necessarily seen that they desperately need one another in order to do that. So that part's fascinating to me. The most interesting part to me is not just that Keeley is having success, because that I'm so glad to see that coming, even though it is late in the game and it feels positioned late in the game rather than throughout the show or the season. There were these little moments where she was just doing her job, and I never got the sense that she was doing her job in a way that made the club somehow better or different than it was before. But I got the impression she was really good at her job and was doing a good job with it. And the question I just ultimately had was like, where's this heading? And where it's heading obviously was being saved for the end here. This big offer that Keeley receives, she's clearly going to go. It makes the most sense for her to go. All of that is great. What I'm not sure about is like, and I do think this tracks, I've long raised to the consternation of some and to the confusion of some, we've got a lot of feedback about this particular issue. I've long said, I don't feel like the moment where Roy quote unquote learned, and he basically just shuffled Keeley into a bathtub as soon as she got home from work, not considering or asking like if that's what she wanted, or if she had anything else to do. I mean, she had been so busy, and she was telling him how busy she was. And then he's like, you're not going to do anything for 3 hours. You're going to sit in this tub. It was an act of love, but it was a little bit an act of misguided love in terms of that might not have been what she needed other than not having Roy hanging over her. She might have needed Roy not hanging over her and had some time to work. And I think that comes to a head here with Roy doing a grand romantic gesture, buying these tickets right to Marbella.
Yeah.
And it's just not right. Like, it's just not right for him to expect that she can, in the middle of her work success, go 6 weeks. And I think the very telling part to me is like, he says, yeah, I know you have to work. That's why you can send your emails and shit on a deck. And it's like, her job is going to be more than just sending out emails and making phone calls, right? Like, she has to be there for people. Like, this is a really important time for her. There's so much logistics she's working out, starting her own thing. She's not going to be just sending emails. That's not what she does. Like, this is a different thing. I think he misunderstands her, but yet he does understand her, because when he saw her in that magazine and said she looks so good and so powerful without me, Like, he understands that she does not need him to do this. And so I think that's the part where he's a little confused as to what he needs to be doing here. And I think I don't think it's a breakup confusion or that they're bad for each other, but I think he's still working very hard to find the happy medium of supporting her, being there for her, and being there for them, and not being absent from that. And so I do think that works. The will they or won't they relationship drama of it all isn't landing as well for me, even though I think they've made it, they've set it up where I can understand why it might work for others. Definitely.
Yeah. Like, it's not my favorite piece of the show. And like, I don't love living in like this concern over like the future of their relationship. So I'm like, I guess like choosing not to. I'm choosing not to be overly concerned about it. The show will do what the show is going to do with it. And I thought that scene was really good. And I think that you just like connected, the flowers in the bathtub to this really, really artfully. So I feel like, for now being like an end point for the relationship, until we get to check back in with these characters, hopefully like next summer, that like, I'm okay here. Like I can live in this spot. It's not my favorite storyline.
Yeah. I'm not like ripping my hair out or like, nope, flagellating my back or punishing myself in anger at where we're at with this. I don't know how you feel, but I feel a little bit conflicted in that. In the same episode, that like her professional success and her career success is only being like, it feels ultimately like it's being presented in this show for the sake of the drama that it creates in her relationship. And I know that that's true to life. Like, I know that that's true to life, that people, especially women, have to work really hard, probably in a lot of careers, by some power, whether it's twice or a power of 10 harder than others, to get the same level of respect or the same level of pay. These issues are predominant and prevalent in the world. So I definitely understand that Keely's success should not be something that we take lightly or we take for granted, and that people who are successful often have to sacrifice for those situations to be successful. They have to sacrifice family. I mean, we talked about Jason Sudeikis going away for 6 months every year to make Ted Lasso. Like, people make sacrifices to be successful professionally all the time. And I understand that that can also be the case with Keely and Roy's relationship. I just don't feel great about how those two things are so inextricably linked on the show, because I wouldn't mind just having a story about Keely being successful without the added connection of, but what impact will this have on her love life?
Right.
Like, I don't feel so great about that at all. Yeah. I don't think the show is intending to make that connection so predominant, but it's hard to ignore it, in my opinion. It's hard to ignore it.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, let's take another quick break. We're going to throw it to our sponsors one more time, a little bit of banter. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about the rest of the finale. So hang tight. We'll be back in a sec. All right, we have returned. So we've talked about the Nate of it all. We've talked about Roy and Keely. Where would you want to go next? A few different options. Like, if we want to stay in sort of like romance land, like, I think like this is like, you know, a good time to talk about where we landed with Sam and Rebecca.
Yep, that's what I want to do.
I mean last week I was like, okay, let's get the Sam spinoff. I'm ready to go, and I really was. Yep. But that's not where we went. We, you know, Sam is sticking around, he's not going anywhere, and I'm obviously thrilled, you know, like, and I loved the post, like sort of like the epilogue scene for Sam starting his restaurant and everything. And I loved getting to see Akufo unmasked, you know, like,
it was
to
incredible. See, like,
the true Akufo was, absolutely unbelievable. One of my favorite scenes of the whole show, yeah. Just like, you know, like crapping on the ground, like fake, like, yes, pantomiming pooping. What is that? Poop to miming. I don't know what you want to call that. I'm going to buy your house. I'm going to crap in every room like that.
And then burn it down, crap on the ashes.
Yeah.
You Nigerian motherfucker.
It was so good. It was so good. It was so funny. I don't know. Give us some AC Mazzaro-isms on the Sam and Richard stuff. The Sam and Rebecca stuff. Sorry.
I feel good about saying I felt Edwin Akufo was a little bit suspect when he was like, you have all the time you need, 72 hours. Like,
yeah.
I feel good about reading that guy was a little bit suspect with all his antics last episode, that he wasn't pure. I felt good when we were about to begin training in this episode and Jamie's like, I have a question, like, what are we going to do about that? And he points at the chopper that is still there. There's nothing, Josh, I know you're riding a helicopter like an ass and like an a-hole kind of guy.
Oh yeah.
Is there any good thing you can do with a chopper?
Yeah. Is there any good thing that you can do with a chopper?
A medevac helicopter could be good.
Yeah. Like a emergency situations. Helicopter is great.
What about people who privately own a helicopter? Is there any way to be good when you're privately in a helicopter?
I was about to say, I'm really trying not to judge here, but like, who am I judging? Like, who's listening to this? You privately own a helicopter and you're listening to this podcast. You better have signed up at patreon.com/kosherrecaps is all I'm saying. A buck a month is not a lot to ask from you with your private blade access.
No way, baby. That's chopper fuel.
You know?
But I just, in and of itself, the chopper should have been the word. But I truly love that scene so much. It makes me laugh. I love that they brought the soundtrack back. Like, I love that his little theme came back as he was giving his big exit.
It's so good.
I love his guy's fake handshake. Like, the handshake guy was going to give Sam the goodbye, and then pulled it away. Oh, man. It was so good. And Sam did not know how to react to it. There's a world where Sam made enemies of Cerithium Oil and Dubai Air, same company. Sam made enemy of Edwin Akufo, like a billionaire. Like, Sam's got all these, like, very high-profile enemies. But I am so hopeful that it plays for comedy, right? That Edwin Akufo is just constantly like sending Sam like to Sam's restaurant, like just rotten food or, you know, just things that he could be doing that are involve him playing like just mean pranks on Sam in some way. Like, I'm here for that. And you said spinoff, Sam's doing a restaurant, Josh, and that's prime spinoff material, Sam's restaurant.
Yeah. Or at least like, you know, Ted Lasso season 4, like, if there's like, I don't know if you still call it Ted Lasso if Ted Lasso isn't around, but like, there's definitely like, I think if anything, if nothing else, like having Sam have one of the three epilogue scenes, and it involves no main characters other than Sam, is such a clear investment in that character's future. Whether that's on the show or in the greater franchise. And that is deeply heartening, because say what you will about like the Sam and Rebecca storyline specifically. I was talking to a friend who's like totally disconnected from like the podcast world and like all of that stuff, just watches the show, never thinks about it again. And we were talking about Ted Lasso because I saw that he was watching it. He's like really, really, really supremely out on the Sam and Rebecca stuff, though loves both of those characters individually. And I think that there are many people who share the sentiment. I think that Sam had and his like prominence in AFC Richmond and ergo the show was a huge net positive in season 2. And so if like what we're setting up here with that epilogue scene is not just that he's still here, not just that he's like recommitting his efforts to being here, it also feels like the show promising like we have not like finished you know, like really digging into Sam as a person and what makes him tick and what are the effects on the world that he may have. Because I think that he is just one of the most powerful characters on the show. He only gets more wonderful. And so like this declaration of intent of having Sam open the restaurant and showing us that was one of the three most important things that they needed to leave us with. I find that to be a great sign and something I'm really excited about.
I think that's a great point, and I'm excited about it as well. I'm not thrilled with some of how we got there with the Sam and Rebecca. I know that story is probably not done either. I want to give a shout out to your great friend, Leslie Goldberg, on the TV's Top 5 podcast and the interview with Bill Lawrence that she and Daniel Feinberg did. She straight up asked Bill Lawrence, should we, in hindsight, have been more uncomfortable with the power dynamic between Rebecca and Sam? And should that have been the thing that we spent more time talking about or focusing on? And what do you feel about that? And Bill Lawrence gave what I felt was, in hindsight, a very circumspect answer. And he sort of said, like, look, this writer's room is really smart. There's a lot of discourse. Bill Lawrence has been famously following it all season, engaging with people on Twitter in a way that a lot of showrunners do not. And maybe that's good for his mental health. Maybe it's bad. Who am I to judge? Because I engage with the masses on Twitter like it is my job. And it's not good for my mental health. But I will say, Bill Lawrence basically said, like, look, if there's a conversation you're having or people are having, odds are they had it in the writer's room. Like, they're very smart. And then he sort of said, like, we sat down and we did the 3-season arcs on all these characters. We had plans for them. And so I took that as a way of him saying, like, if you're not feeling great about Sam and Rebecca, stay tuned. Like, there's probably going to be more in that realm. It certainly did not feel finalized, right? It doesn't feel final to me. It felt like Sam said to Ted as his Rebecca stand-in, which getting, you know, pulling that lens back and taking in, like, okay, so then what these characters are saying is what Jason Sudeikis really feels about his life. But anyway, Sam speaking to Ted as Rebecca saying, I wish I could say I stayed because of my feelings for you. I did not. I stayed because it was the right thing for me to do, for my personal story. And it's like, okay, well, that does not end the Sam and Rebecca situation. It just means Sam didn't stay because of her, but they may not be done. I don't know how the power dynamic's going to come back into play on that front. Just like with Edwin Akufo, and with, some of the other things that we talked about on this podcast, I still feel like there's a world where that comes out in a very bad way, a tabloid way, in a Rupert anger way, in a West Ham getting in their heads, trying to bury Rebecca kind of way. I'm trying to remember, is that something Nate knew about Rebecca? That's not, right?
Not that I can recall. No, yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah, so I don't know if that could come out that way or somewhere else. I just feel like there may be other shoes to drop in this regard. And I'm fine with Rebecca and Sam never being a thing again, but I definitely want to continue to have more of Sam than we did in series one, like we did here in series two. And I'm glad the restaurant gives us an opportunity to do that separate and apart from the football club, and certainly separate and apart from Rebecca.
Yeah. And I think, like, just like, you know, potentially like a new setting for the show, you know, as the show continues to grow, you know, like a new place to hang out other than just like the hallowed halls of AFC Richmond, the pub, you know, like give us a couple of different places to check in on. I think that that's always fun. And so to have like these opportunities to like not just hang out with Sam potentially, but who's going to come to Sam's, right? Like who's going to show up and who's going to get to have like moments of comedy, of drama, of wisdom, like what great scenes are going to occur here. It just feels like a really great, important potential destination for season three to explore. So I'm psyched about that. I think that's great. And I do think that like what he says at the end of the season to Rebecca, but looking at Ted while he says it, does feel to me in some regards to be like Sam breaking up with Rebecca, you know, like Sam being like, I wish I could say it, you know, I'm here for you, but I'm not, like I'm here right for me, you know, like. And so if they've both kind of like mutually reached this place, then I think it's you know, well within the realm of possibility that like this is the show being like, if not done with this storyline, then at least maybe done with like their mutual continued attempt at a romance. And now we're in like, you know, sort of like in like the post romance, like we're in like sort of like the history it's like the romantic history and how that informs the future type stuff. I don't know. Hard to predict. We always say like we've stopped predicting stuff and then we just keep trying to do it anyway.
That's fair.
What are you going to do? I kind of feel like, I'm done with it, but like also it happened. And so like there's some degree to which like it's inauthentic to not acknowledge it. And especially when, Bill Lawrence is out here saying we've considered all of these arcs and all of this stuff, which I think is definitely a thing that you, can and probably should say as a showrunner, but like we'll never get the receipts, you know, we've got no eyes in the room of like, did anyone like pipe in being like, hey, this is actually like a really awkward and frankly problematic power dynamic that's at play here that perhaps we should explore conversationally before we decide whether or not we want to go through with this, or at least like discuss how it would impact the storyline. Like we have no idea if anyone said anything like that, or if that's like an ethos in the room. We just have no idea. all we can do is take the showrunner's word for it, and it's the showrunner's job to defend the show. So I don't know where I land on, like, everything is planned, especially coming from somebody who I think, and I mean this in, with no disrespect to the showrunner, or to one of the creators of the show, at least, in Bill Lawrence. But isn't Bill Lawrence the one who's also said, like, it would be great to, like, go past three seasons if we can get the right idea? But it's like, you know, Jason's call about Jason's, you know, storyline. So, like, maybe, like, my trust is not all the way there. You know, long way of saying that. But yeah,
I think we're going to get a three season arc that was pretty much planned. That is the Jason Sudeikis Ted Lasso story, and then where it goes from there, I don't know. And I'm of a couple minds here. Like, I really do hope they make the third season as they intended it, and without this sort of setup for, oh, well, here's how we could do more. Here's how we want to do more. Like, I want them to make the show that Jason Sudeikis had kicking around in his head for so many years that they seemingly arced out from the beginning, at least to certain extents, the things that they seeded, the things we're getting into. I do want that. But certain things feel like they have been added or changed, which is also fine. There's a good discussion about that in the TV's Top 5 podcast as well. Like, how do you not account for the fact that, yes, maybe you arc out three seasons, but then you get Hannah Waddingham and Juno Temple in a room together.
Right.
And how do you not want to just put them in as many scenes as possible? How do you not want to let that influence the stories that you're telling, because these two actors are so good together and clearly on and off screen? It works so well. So that's a big thing. But yeah, I just, with the Sam stuff, I do think the Sam stuff feels like it was part of a plan to give us more Sam after season one, and I'm happy for that. The ultimate end of it, that it came as a part of the relationship story, especially when, okay, we can talk about all these arcs. I don't necessarily feel like I have the best grasp on the trajectory of Rebecca's story. What she's striving for, like, what's happening, like. What's happening in terms of her arc is maybe a little bit lost on me. And I know the contextualization of of that in the beginning of this season was she wants to get to a place where she's okay being vulnerable again, when she's okay giving of herself to another and letting herself be exposed and being hurt again. Like, that's all really important for her to move on from what the pain of the situation with Rupert caused her to do in season one. Now that she put that behind her and made her peace with that, it's about making her peace with getting back to good again, making Rebecca great again, literally. And I don't know exactly where I feel we're at with that. And I don't feel like I like that. All of that seems to be in the context of relationships, but I will say, like, she seems to kick ass in so many other ways that I don't know. I understand why this is her sort of thing that she has to get past, because she's destroying it as an owner. She's doing such a good job. She's so powerful. Like, she really is such an inspiration for Keeley. I love that relationship. I love the scene between the two of them. I loved how Higgins articulated, like, what a great mentor is versus a good one. And I knew that Rebecca was a great mentor for Keeley. I love them both sobbing about it. Like, that was all really, really good to me. I just don't really need Rebecca and Sam anymore. I don't need it for Rebecca or Sam. And I want them both to be having these things that advance their characters. I don't know right now how I feel about that story being in this season. But I am reserving the right to say I have a problem with it, because I do want to see what we do with that in season three.
Do you want to talk about Trent Crim?
I was just going to say, speaking of things that I want to talk about for what they do with in season three, how about our boy Trent Crim? Can't ride a bike. Can't ride a bike. That's the first thing that's up with him.
That's a surprise.
That's because of the overall vibe.
The overall vibe gives me, Trent Crim can ride a bike, would be my takeaway. Trent Crim has gone full independent. He's out at the independent for having revealed Nate as the anonymous source. So Trent Crim is independent. Antonio, do we like this? Do we like a world where Trent Crim potentially is no longer part of, like, the gaggle of reporters, but is instead somebody who can, write whatever it is he wants to write, such as, I don't know, the official Ted Lasso biography that Apple TV Plus will then release as a tie-in book at the end of season three, because that's the world we live in.
Yes, 100% would buy that book. 100% would buy that book. Really, really would buy that book. I like reading football books anyway. Football biographies, whether authorized or unauthorized, are an extremely popular genre of sport books, or just books in general. Most footballers will write a book and they'll tell some of the stories of the big moments or incidents from their career. They will slate some people. They will rate others. Like, they really, really, these books are famous for what they give in terms of insight into the game. And I have read authorized biographies of football managers. I've read unauthorized ones. I've read ones where the reporter had access, ones where they didn't. The Trent Crim one, in the situation with Ted, if that were to be the case, Trent suggests he's looking into something deeper. That certainly would suggest novel to me, not novel, but biography to me. In that world, I could see Ted loosely playing along with it and being okay with it, but not really going all in on it. And I feel like that could be, I mean, it is great to hear the story in season one when Trent writes the positive story about Ted. In my mind, I hear some of that in Trent's voice, right? Like, I hear the cosign ultimately and how big of a deal that was. Even though I know it's Higgins reading it to Rebecca, there's this sort of hybrid of it where it is Trent's voice. And it's like, I don't know what a book does for this. And I know I'm guilty of this because I just spent time criticizing relationships and all of this show's focus on them, even though this is a show about relationships. But I want to know, like, if Trent Crim writes the Ted Lasso biography and maybe he gets into the real deep stuff, right? How much of this does, like, for example, a Michelle Lasso know? And is it the book or maybe some of the insight into Ted that changes that situation? Because if Ted's going to return, I don't need him to get back with Michelle. I just thought it was very interesting that we had the text exchange between Michelle and Ted at the beginning of this episode in the way that we did. I was glad that she was there for him in that moment, but I think it spoke a lot that she wasn't really there for him. He was sort of deflecting with humor, and she said, "You're obviously fine." Like, I think that's her misunderstanding what obviously fine is with Ted Lasso. And that speaks to him maybe not letting her know when he isn't obviously fine.
Right.
So I don't know. Is there a world in this show where Trent writes the book about Ted and something is in that book that recontextualizes Ted for Michelle? Or is there any Ted and Michelle left to go? I just don't know what else of a point the book would have other than getting people to respect Ted. If Trent's going to write the book, it'll be funny to see Trent and Ted interacting with each other and have that hanging out there. But the written word, other than selling it to us, I don't know the actual narrative impact of it.
Nate.
It causes Nate to come around. That's a good point. Nate could read the book and say, okay, I feel bad now. I mean, I feel like Nate already feels bad and he just leaned into the darkness.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe.
But if
maybe
there's like, you know, like he, like you can only spit at yourself in the mirror so much, you know, like it, like, you know, so many hours of your day can only be spent like that. Like, is he going to read the book? Will that change the calculus for Nate in some
point.
Capacity? Like, I think like that's a character who this could have massive impact on. I think a more narrative utility could be, other characters, you know, learning through like Ted's example about themselves. You know, that's like the beauty of stories, right? That like in somebody who is very different from you, you see some piece of yourself or your own life and it makes you think about that stuff. Like that's, that's art working. So like could a biography do something similar for a bunch of these other characters in the continued Lasso effect. But this is all assuming that there is a book, that there is more to like Trent Crim doing stuff with Ted rather than this just being like, we're just like writing out Trent Crim. But why would they have even bothered with this scene at all? Right. Like what's the point of this scene? If not, to like, set something else in motion, you know, I think like that is off, not always, but it is often a function of a season finale, is to like close close some doors and open new ones. And this felt like both like a door closing and another one opening, even as Trent was literally struggling to open his car door. So
I love that character note, by the way.
Yeah, very good. Very good.
Joe Cool, great car, great hair, great look. Yeah. And guy can't pull it off because he locked his keys in his car.
So I'm interested. I'm interested to see where this goes. And I at least appreciate that, like, hey, I can appreciate journalistic burnout. That is certainly something that I can see, and like I can feel that, and like I appreciate that. And I appreciate that, like the show, like kind of addressed that like Trent writes something that Trent has to write, and that Trent finds unpalatable, and maybe like uncorks something that Trent Crim, as a journalist, had been feeling for a minute. You know, like that's a story that I don't think that I anticipated. I thought that they were just like going to have this be like a wholly irresponsible thing that he did with no further interrogation. And is it like a pretty still like surface level light interrogation? Yeah, but at least like it engaged it a bit, and like I can do some extrapolation for sure of when you find something that is just like really really grimy and it doesn't feel right and you don't want to do this, and like enough of those moments that can push you into a different direction. Like I felt like that worked for me with Trent here. I'm just glad that they engaged it at all.
I also really liked how Trent said when Ted made the joke, the dad joke, it was a literal dad joke. It was a joke that Trent's father had also made. And it made me feel like for a show that has had so many father issues and relationship issues, anytime a father gets mentioned, I'm on high alert, right? And it's like, maybe part of the reason that Trent is so interested in Ted is because he sees a little bit of his father in him. Whether it's the goofiness or the jokes or the you know, the charm and the wit, whatever it is, there's a connection there. I just don't, it's not by accident that Trent mentions his father there. Just like it's not by accident that we see him lock his keys in his car. Like those are clear choices and clear moments. They're giving us a little bit peek behind the curtain into Trent Crim. I suspect we're going to get a much deeper peek behind that curtain in the third season. And I'm here for it. I can't wait.
Yeah. What other free kicks do we want to do? Horticulture, baby.
Horticulture,
We got to shout that out.
Everybody, the people, the patrons of Post Show Recaps in the Discord seem to love that line. And I'm a fan. I'm going to say that anytime I'm watering my plants as well. Really, really like that beardism. Speaking of like, just the connections between things and, stuff that we, you know, we were tracking or, what's happening here? A lot of cyclical stuff here. We begin the season with the murder of Earl Greyhound, and football is life, and life begins again. And we have mascot Idol with Tina Fey Hound, and I forget what the other dog's name was, but Macy Greyhound. We're bringing those back into the mix, and Danny makes the penalty kick. So not only do we begin and end the season on Nate's face, but we begin the season with Danny having a huge penalty kick moment. We end the season the same way. I thought really smart writing. I like that. I also really like the writing of Ted being so screwed up that he mixed up the salt and the sugar and the cookies, but maybe not to negative effect because Rebecca said,
"Ooh, that's not going to work." You know,
she's a sneaky, salty bitch like Heather Locklear on Melrose Place.
And you know what, Heather Locklear, honestly, on Melrose Place, like you could say a lot about Amanda Woodward, but I don't know how sneaky she was. I think she was pretty cards up that she was coming after you. Anyway, that's just we could talk about Melrose Place another time. But like the salt and sugar switcheroo, like I don't know that it's going to yield this effect. I feel like that was a pretty big baking faux pas that is going to render the thing that he made inedible almost.
Yes, he did not do well in the technical. Let's just say that. Ted did not nail the technical.
I love a salty sweet combo. Don't get me wrong. I think that there is much to be done in that realm. But I think like the full swap of the salt and the sugar in the cookie is not going to go well.
Speaking of a swapping salt, Do you think we're going to see Susan, the dog breeder, again, who was really interested in Keeley there? What was the point of that scene and that character?
I have no idea. Just gags? I think just gags.
It was funny. I did laugh. Keeley is, she's constantly, no matter what situation Keeley ends up in, finding somebody who is very interested in Keeley, to say the least, whether it is a young man in his early 20s or the only female greyhound breeder in all of London or whatever the Susan's the dog breeder's title was. Keeley's always finding somebody who's interested in Keeley. So I don't know what to make of that particular scene. If that we're doing like introducing characters in the finale or we're going to see him again or highlighting things, as you said, opening doors as we're closing them. I didn't know if that was a door that was being opened or not. I really don't think it is, but you never know. I also, speaking of doors being closed and others being opened, I really thought it was good how Ted sort of, we talked about how Ted was reacting and responding to Michelle, but then we saw Ted's like leaving the house and all of the public's response to him, including the wanker guy, who really kind of laid into him about the beaches of Normandy, but then said, just do the work, pal, and you'll be all right, which felt like the nicest thing the guy ever said to him. He called him pal.
Yeah.
So Ted feels like he's made some progress there, and I like seeing how that really evolved. I do wish we could see some more of these, the ensemble, if you will, some more of these people who have been in multiple episodes now. The more we feature them, the better. I like basically everybody that's popped up in small roles on this show. And that's why I wondered about the dog breeder, because we do seem to see characters again. Speaking of seeing characters again, Josh, we didn't get Dr. Sharon in this episode. We got a great Dr. Sharon voice memo for Ted in this episode, but we didn't get Dr. Sharon in this episode. It seems clear from, I just feel like she will be playing a part in series 3 of the show. Whether it's from casting news or interviews, it just feels like that's going to happen. I don't know. Do you feel okay that she was taken off the board in the way she was before the finale and that she was there for Ted, but not there in this episode?
Well, I think that the work was there, right? Like, you know, like the impact of Ted and Sharon's time together was very present in the finale. And like the Ted Lasso of the final episode is like unrecognizable from the Ted who's dealing with Dr. Sharon earlier in the season. So in like that way, I think that can be a very effective thing, like the absence of a character being as strong as like that character's presence. With that said, I love Dr. Sharon very, very much and want to see her on the show always now. And I think with this time jump, with with everybody knowing what they know about Ted now, with Ted's incredible public comments about like we do a really bad job talking about mental health in our society, and I would love for that to change. That's something that needs to change. That I think that there is I can see the path where like Dr. Sharon is back as like a full-time employee at Richmond in season 3. Like, I think like something like that would make a lot of sense to me. But another thing that would make a lot of sense to me would be seeing Dr. Sharon with Nate potentially. I think is like a pairing that you could imagine that like Nate's going to need some help getting out of this. And I know again, like people's interests in like, that guy doesn't need my help. You know, I get it. I totally do. But I think that the show is probably interested in it. So I think that those are a couple of different paths to see Sharon back on the show.
I'm looking forward to it. I really thought that was such a great character that was introduced. And I wasn't sure because she was standoffish and it just seemed like there was some level of like not returning Ted's like outgoing charm and kindness, but seeing why and like understanding that you're never required to match someone's energy, right? Like, especially if they're like, try smiling more, be nicer. Like, I'm not criticizing her for that. I just thought it was weird that she didn't wave back to him. You know what I mean? Like, but we should never expect characters to match Ted's energy, especially. And finding out why she didn't and finding out her vulnerabilities and learning more about that character was one of the great successes of this season for me. And one of the things I really liked the most about this season. So I would love to see Dr. Sharon back. And I would like to see her back in a capacity that gives us more about her, gives us more of her story, Gives us more of finding out what she wants out of the world and how she can get it. And I hope to God it's not relationship based. That's all I can really say. I want to see some Dr. Sharon in this in the third season, and I do think we will see it. I think that has been all but confirmed. So I'm excited for that. I'm excited for that for sure. And I feel great about how she was in this episode. You're right. Like, the work was there. Her presence was felt in every moment that Ted was not completely waylaid.
The entirety of the way that Ted handled everything, which, like, I don't know what I expected, you know, like, coming into this, like, how was this all going to be handled with everybody knowing about his panic attacks? And I, like the graciousness, the openness, I was really impressed with the portrayal of Ted in this episode. Made me really happy with that direction of the show. And I think your points earlier about if the takeaway is did I neglect something, did I cause something, I think that these are questions that sometimes you do end up having, you know, I think that you can't help as a human but feel like, what did I do wrong, when the answer is you didn't do anything wrong. If you did anything wrong, you committed the unavoidable sin of interacting with another person, you know, you know, so
these podcasts are sins. Are they mortal or venial, or what are we doing here?
Yeah, I mean, every day, professional sinners over here.
Remember, speaking of which, the sinner returns on USA next week.
I was just gonna say, remember we used to podcast about that for 5 minutes?
Yeah,
I had a great time doing that, but it is one of those things when I think back on all the things you and I have podcasted about, and someone would then say, "Oh, remember when you guys did Sinner season 2?" I'd be like, "Oh yeah,
I guess we did.
I guess he did do that.
Yeah, I love the Sinner. I can't wait for it to come back.
I know you can't. But yeah. Anyway, I feel like these are things that you can't help but feel. So I'm interested in the show's exploration of that, and wanting to get it vocalized by Ted of really wanting to hear that acceptance of you it's not quitting if somebody you didn't quit, you didn't fail, it's nothing like that. It's you're not in control of everything. You're not you cannot expect to be in control of everybody. You cannot determine whether or not someone likes you or likes what you did. You can and you really ought to try very hard not to be an a-hole to the people around you. But there are times that you're going to make a choice that is in your best interest decisively based on all of the accounting that you have done, and someone's going to be really upset about it, and that sucks. But it's not born out of malice, it's born out of reality. And there are ways to deal with that are healthy, and there are ways to deal with that are not healthy, and there are ways to react to when something like that happens to you that are healthy, and ways to react to that stuff very unhealthily. And I think that the show has a lot of room to explore all of that messiness. And I think that that is a thing that I appreciate about season 2 of this show, is that it got messier. That it did it did add a couple of additional dimensions to what it means to be alive. And it's not just about find the joy in every situation and everything will be okay. That's really easy to say and almost impossible to practice. And I think that there is still further work to be done in all of this, but that's what a third season is for. So I'm excited to see what they do with the mental health angle and the emotional health angle and how to get to places where you can feel comfortable just breathing. I think are things that the show really strived to highlight in season 2, and did a really, I thought, terrific job with Ted specifically, and Jason Sudeikis, his performance, the writing of the character in that final episode of season 2. And I think it sets the stage for a lot of really interesting exploration to go deeper in season 3.
Definitely. And everything you just said was so well put and on point. And I think it is vocalized and localized in Dr. Sharon's message to Ted when she says, the truth will set you free. Doing the work and being honest with yourself and being vulnerable and letting yourself be out there in the world, it will set you free, but it'll piss you off first. Or first it'll piss you off is the way that she put it. And I think we're in some of the first it'll piss you off stage. It's like, yes, Ted, doing the work and doing this truth is what will ultimately free you from the prison that it, that you've created by virtue of needing to do this, right? But there's going to be some bumps in the road. Like, at first, it's going to piss you off. Like, it's going to piss you off. You're going to feel like, I shouldn't be doing this. It's making me angry. Like, all the ways that it did. She just, in like one sentence, really summed up what you're talking about. Like, in terms of how it's all part of it. Like, yes, it's going to be unavoidable that when you focus on yourself and when you do these things, some people are not going to be happy about the result. Like, and so that's going to piss you off, but ultimately it will set you free. Like, you're going to feel better about what happens just by being authentic and by being true and by being true to that and being vulnerable and real and all the things that authenticity will help Ted Lasso. And Dr. Sharon has recognized that. And she recognizes too that it's not going to be easy. First, it will piss him off. Like, that's where we're at. And I think that there's definitely room to continue along these lines, and I'm here for it. And I'm also here for the fact that Dr. Sharon was here for Ted. I love that. I'm also here for the fact that Beard was here for Ted. I love that Beard is, like I said earlier, sort of Ted's like, Ted is the Beard whisperer, but Beard is the Ted whisperer in many ways. Not just that he puts the article in his pocket and claims to have not seen it, but that later on, in a, just a subtle way, he encourages the confrontation with Nate, saying basically like, you know what, Ted, sometimes it's okay to be a little angry. Some people need a push. Like, you can't hold all this in. Your mustache will pop off, is what Beard says, which is hilarious. And then great joke about how Ted would look like that fellow from The Hangover, Bradley Cooper, not at home.
Yeah, not at home.
Right. But I like that Beard played that role with Ted in this episode. I also liked, we have not talked about, Roy Kent and the Diamond Dogs, Josh. That was really very funny, except for Nate's role in it. But just Roy's reaction to the Diamond Dogs was great. And Roy saying that Keeley's, that him not being in the picture with Keeley hurt his feeling, singular.
Yeah, my
so
feeling.
So funny to me.
Really,
Roy has
my
one feeling.
Feeling.
Yeah. He has one feeling. That's part of his issue, right? It's like this perpetual state of like either anger or frustration or just calm. And he's walking around a clenched fist wanting to headbutt the world. He has one feeling, and this hurt that one feeling.
I loved that. I thought
love
that was great.
Love the Diamond Dog scene. Love that. It does, though, I think it does remind us that, you know, when Roy gets Keeley's news, he basically says, you aren't going to have time for me anymore. That's what he says to Keeley in the middle of the episode. And that's fascinating to me because, like, while Roy does have the one feeling, the one feeling is wrapped up in a lot here, and he's probably in his own head about some of this stuff. And it maybe he does need the 6 weeks in Marbella to get past this, and maybe we'll come back and everything will be fine. That would be great with me. But I do think that the one feeling made me laugh, even as Nate complaining that he deserved to be headbutted and seeing that as a microaggression, not being taken as seriously as Roy was taking Jamie, really cast a pall over everything that happened in that office and was all part of the Nate story more than anything else. But Ted and Beard's reactions to Roy approving of the Diamond Dogs, also one of the funniest things in the season.
Yes.
So funny.
They were so excited. They were so excited. Everyone was so happy about it, except for Nate.
Not being happy, the Renaissance painting of masculine melancholy was also a thing that cracked me up.
That was good. That was good. There's a lot of like little moments. Like I was a little worried that there wasn't like going to be enough time to deal with like so much stuff, but there was not only like enough time to deal with like just about all of like the big stories, but also like room for like this episode spent like an entire like 2 minutes on Edwin Akufo's freak out, right?
Yes.
You know, like, so like, there was all of this room for all this stuff. Like, I did not have like Danny Rojas needs to like redeem the killing of Earl the Greyhound moment. Right. You know, like, that wasn't something that like I even like thought had to happen here. And like they made time for so much stuff. I was impressed with just how much was accomplished in the finale.
Little character moments like Isaac leading the team to touch the sign, or Will dropping the thing in the back of the Renaissance painting, or Will witnessing the Roy and Jamie confrontation. Will just being an awkward, funny moment in the background of these scenes is great for him.
Yeah.
We even got a Jan Moss moment, Josh. Jan Moss is the guy to stand up for the tactic.
Yes. So, like, you know, like, they took the time to, like, give everybody something.
Yep. Including a helmet on the new Earl Greyhound.
Yes.
Whether that was Macy Gray or Tina Fey. That was very funny. So, yeah. They took the time. We took the time. I have a question for you. Do you want still water or sparkling water at this point, Josh?
Just, like, generally. I'll tap is fine.
Tapas, you're a tapas guy.
Just the tap is fine. I'll take some tap. Tap,
yeah, New York has great tap water. You would like it.
I'll take the
you
tap. Would like it. I'll take the tap.
The 5 weeks or 5 days, 3 weeks, 2 days, or whatever the structure was, 5-3-2, literally a pyramid of football tactics. 5-3-2, five at the back, three in the middle, two up top. Like, so you're building a pyramid. That is not by accident, I would submit. And so that's definitely there. I love the Run the Jewels needle drop at the end. Run the Jewels, one of my favorite musical acts. So to hear RTJ at the end there with Nate's heel turn was at least a pleasant way to ride that out. So I really like that moment as well. I don't have anything else in my notes, Josh, other than whistle, whistle in all caps. I don't know what that means. I'm just
Well, maybe that's... What do you got? What do you have?
Fuck you, Piers Morgan. That's it.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. Fair enough.
A well-deserved FU to Piers Morgan. The world cheered when that was uttered.
Well played. Well, the good news is if anything comes up between now and next week, we will have another podcast to address it. We're not done talking Ted Lasso. The Ted Lasso talk continues. We will be back next week. Could be like a day or two late. We'll see. But we are definitely coming back with one more show where we will, if you've got feedback, we'll go over it. Ted Lasso at postshowrecaps.com. You can also talk to us in the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord, where once again, even at the $5 level, you can sign up and be part of the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord for the month of October. Consider it patreon.com/postshowrecaps. You can talk to us about all things Ted Lasso season 2. We'll get into it. May even have a special guest along the way. So it should be a really fun time for at least one more additional Ted Lasso talk before we are done looking at all things season 2. You can hit us up on Twitter also. Did you know that? You can do that. I'm at Round Howard Antonio. You're at AC Mazzara with how many Z's? How many R's?
As many seasons of Ted Lasso as there have been, and as many R's as there are to go.
Yeah.
At least so we think.
2-1. All right, Antonio, anything else you want to talk about before we close out?
No, that's really it. I felt very good about this finale on so many levels. I was really satisfied with everything that went down there. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the B in BILF stands for. I guess it's boss. When Roy calls Keely a BILF, right. I guess it's boss. Yeah. I hope it's not anything else.
Yes, yes. Well, just a couple of BILFs signing out here.
BILFs. I think we're PILFs, Josh, podcasters.
Yes, yes. I'd like to be friends with.
Yes.
We will return next week with some more Ted Lasso coverage. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers.